compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. This is Taco Tuesday, and you will notice some Taco Tuesday music today in honor of Taco Tuesday. You always do every Tuesday. Cyrus, that blood tennis shoe story that everybody's buzzing about, I've prepared some commentary on that.
Oh, I cannot wait for this. All right, let's hear
Well, I wanted to give it a day, and like everybody and his brother is buzzing about the what is it? It's like a knock. Well, it's not a knockoff Nike tennis shoe. It's a Nike tennis shoe that's been altered, as I understand it, to include a kind of a clear pouch or cell at the bottom that's got some human blood in it. I think what it is it's like 66 grams of red ink and one drop of human blood. Do I have that right?
That sounds right. And they're making 666 of these. It's very blatant what's what this is all about.
Right. Well, I did stay up late, and I spent a considerable amount of time preparing some commentary on that. Are you ready? Should we start with that?
Yeah, I'm rolling. Let's do it.
Okay. All right. It's really stupid. Ignore it. Okay. What else do you want to talk about today?
I think that is that's how all news should be.
It didn't take me long to write that.
You covered it. We're good. All right, moving on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really stupid. Ignore it. Done.
Love it.
Yeah. That's the best way to do it. 888-914-9149 is the number. As you know, this is very much a caller-driven program. I have a lot of topics I like to get into, but I'd like to hear what you have to say. The number is 888-914-9149. Cyrus, I grew up on science fiction, so Ray Bradbury, Arthur C. Clarke, you know, all the biggies. I had the collections of science fiction stories, and they're all more or less about like space exploration and contact with alien races that come here or we go there.
You know, you're speaking my language, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love that stuff. And I saw the movies, you know, when they would make movies out of some of their books and things like 2010 was the sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke. So anyway, just to kind of establish my street credentials, I really like that stuff and I grew up reading it and I find it fascinating. And so when I saw this story, I thought of all of our listeners. A strange distant space object is sending out ultra low frequency radio signals. Now, this is an article that we'll post so you can read it for yourself. But here's the long and the short of it. Researchers have detected ultra-low radio frequencies being emitted from what they're calling a jellyfish-shaped object in a distant galaxy cluster. The mysterious object.
I saw this episode.
Now, should you use the Force?
No, this is pure Star Trek.
Okay, pure Star Trek.
Pure Star Trek.
Okay. So live long and prosper. Oh, you had that ready, didn't you? That's pretty good. You've got an array of sound effects.
I always have that ready.
Yeah. And Uhura, what did she do exactly?
I want the jellyfish story. Tell me about the aliens.
But see, you've sidetracked me now. You know, I saw something shiny. Now I'm thinking about the bridge of the Star Trek Enterprise. The Starship Enterprise. See how little I watched it? I can't even get the lingo down. So Lieutenant Uhura, she was, it seems like the only thing she ever did was to like raise a hailing frequency. And when she wasn't raising a hailing frequency, what else did she do?
She was the hardest working person in Starfleet. How dare you?
What else did she do?
I don't know.
Have you ever seen her do anything other than raise a hailing frequency?
That's right. That was the first interracial kiss on television.
That's true.
And her.
That's true. Yeah, that was a first.
Well, she did more than kiss Kirk, though. I'm not just saying that's all she did.
Yeah. Fascinating. Did you get
that?
Come on,
I want to.
Did
yes,
you get what I just
yeah,
did?
Yeah, bravo.
All right, Mr. Star Trek.
Come on, tell me about this jellyfish emitting radio signals from halfway across the galaxy.
Put your seatbelt back on. Settle down. Okay, so researchers have detected ultra-low radio frequencies being emitted from... You started it because you were playing the Star Trek music. That's what threw me off. Okay, just
please,
pipe down.
Please.
The mysterious object is located 340 million light years from Earth in the galaxy cluster Abell, that's A-B-E-L-L, 2877, according to Science News. The researchers behind a paper published in the Astrophysical Journal say they used the Murchison Wide Field Array. That's what I would have used if anyone had asked me. What are you going to use? I would use the Murchison Wide Field Array. It's a radio telescope in Western Australia.
We don't have the power.
Now, are you doing the new, the Simon Pegg version, or the other guy?
It doesn't matter.
I think Simon Pegg is more fun.
Yeah, I'm terrible at that.
Okay, could you please stop interrupting me until I call you for that?
All right, go.
So they use the radio telescope, Western Australia, blah, 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 blah. They discovered that the ultra-low radio frequencies were coming from this object, and they discovered a distinct shape. We looked at the data. Torrance Hodgson, who's the lead author and PhD candidate from the International Center for Radio Astronomy Research in Perth in Australia, he says, we looked at the data, and as we turned down the frequency, we saw a ghostly jellyfish-like structure begin to emerge. Researchers dubbed the object USS Jellyfish, but don't be quick to assume that it's a nod to Star Trek, Cyrus. That's actually in the article.
My name's in the article.
Your name isn't. I'm just putting it in there. They probably had people in mind like you who are going to immediately think of Star Trek. USS actually indicates an ultra-steep spectrum radio frequency. As you can imagine, the article says, studying radio frequencies from 340 million light years away presents its own special set of challenges. Hodgson said, we've had to undertake some cosmic archaeology to understand the ancient background story of the jellyfish. However, they've been able to develop a working theory of where it's coming from, a supermassive black hole that created powerful jets of plasma about 2 billion years ago. This plasma faded, went quiet, and lay dormant, Hodgson said. Then quite recently, two things happened. The plasma started mixing at the same time as very gentle shock waves passed through the system. This has briefly reignited the plasma, lighting up the jellyfish and its tentacles for us to see. Hopefully, the article says, we won't have to wait long until researchers discover more about the cosmic jellyfish, since construction on the new Square Kilometer Array, SKA, has begun. Researchers anticipate that the radio telescope will give us a far better look at the object. And what they're saying is this new radio telescope will be 1,000 times more sensitive and have much better resolution than the current one, with which they can already see this mysterious outline. So it'll give them a first look at some of the galaxies that have emerged in the universe. And they still don't know exactly what this is that's doing this, but they think it has to do with those plasma jets. So
that
there it is.
Is fascinating.
I mean, think, you know, what boggles my mind, Cyrus, and this is what makes me believe in God even more so, is when science points to things like this, 340 billion light years. Now, the distance that light travels in a second is something along the lines of, what is it, like 144,000 miles a second?
Sure.
And so if that beam of light is traveling for 1 year, so 144,000 miles times however many seconds in a year is how far, you know, light will travel in 1 year. But now multiply that by billions of years, billions. And I don't know how it can be that many billions of years old. I thought that the universe was only like 15 billion or 14 billion years old. But it's been traveling for so long that I have to wonder if maybe the object that started transmitting this is long gone.
Oh,
you know, like light that you see from a star today.
Right.
It may not even be there anymore.
Science!
It's just taken that long for the light to get to us. It's mind-boggling.
So what happens when and if alien life is proven? What does that do
up,
to
for example?
Right? What does that do to our Catholic faith?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that question, because that's the natural question I think that anybody would ask. Like, all right, if some advanced civilization showed up in their spacecraft or in some other way, what does that do to our belief system that, you know, we believe in God and Jesus came here to this planet?
I didn't read no aliens in the Bible.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is that we're told over and over again that not only Jesus Christ specifically, but God as such is the Lord of the universe. And when the Bible was written, of course, the people who were observing the stars, they had some knowledge of the stars. They didn't know much compared to what we know now, but they knew that these were places out there somewhere. And, you know, by the time we get to like the Middle Ages, you've got the capability of determining the distances and things like that. I don't even know how they did that. But my point is that we've known all along that there's stuff out there, and we call that the universe. This is part of the universe. So for me, to answer your question, it's a very simple answer. If it turns out that there are neighbors somewhere in the universe and they are sentient, intelligent creatures that have reason, then they are a new mission field. It doesn't change my view of Christianity at all. In fact, if anything, it makes it more exciting, if you ask me, because it means that what we've previously thought of as the universe, which God is Lord of and King of, includes now some other people who need to be evangelized. I don't know how we'll do that, but I find that to be a very interesting possibility.
I love it. I think it's exciting.
I'll volunteer you to take your Bible and go up into the ship. You'll be the first one to go up in there.
Maybe not first.
Red Rover, yeah. Send Cyrus on over, and then we'll send you into the ship. And then you come back and tell me, you know, what you think I should talk about first. Should I talk about grace or sola scriptura? They probably don't believe in sola scriptura. But anyway, that's my honest answer. I have no fear of contact with alien races. If they're there, great. If they're not there, that's okay too. But it won't change my belief in Jesus or the faith. It doesn't shake my faith in God at all, because he's the Lord of everything, including that.
I love it.
Yeah. Would you and I be on the same? 186,000 miles a second, says the Daily Capital. Thank you. Let me like that. He popped up on Twitter. I'm assuming it's a he. He popped up on Twitter and he said 186,000 miles. That's even faster than I thought. So if you were going at 144,000 miles a second, Cyrus, you would not be going as fast as the speed of light. 186,000 miles a second.
I can't even comprehend what that means.
There is a video. I'll see if I can't find it. It's not something we could play on the show, but there is a video that shows from the perspective of being like on the surface of the sun, and you are the camera, that is, it is moving away from the sun at the speed of light. And you see how quickly you get to, you know, like Mercury. And then it's surprising how long it takes. You know, it's into the minutes before you finally get to Earth. And then I think this video, I don't know how long, it must last an hour, because it takes like half an hour or more before the light gets to Jupiter. And it's surprising. It's fascinating to me, just these vast distances that light traverses. Anyway, again, it points to me all the more that God exists.
Yeah, I think that stuff's so fascinating. I love how you can look out into space and see galaxies, and they are they're almost like the same image as when you take a microscope and you zoom in 100 times.
Yeah.
And
to go inward
yeah. looks to us the same as going outward. But
yeah.
Fascinating imagery with that.
I think
that
we might have talked about this once before, but I'll just pop this in there. I know we have phone calls waiting, but I've often wondered if maybe human beings are kind of in a midpoint. So we look out on the telescope and we see these vast, incomprehensible distances, you know, billions of light years, objects billions of light years away that are moving outward. You know, there's the centrifugal force, it seems, in the universe, that everything is moving away from things. How can that be? I mean, how is all this space there? But in any case, I wonder if, like you were saying, if we were to look inward, and as we do with electron microscopes, and we see the distances between, you know, molecules and atoms, and you go deeper and deeper, and you find other particles. I'm sure we're not done yet finding and discovering the things that lie within. Sometimes it's just interesting to imagine that maybe we're like at the midpoint of the distances, whether you consider going outward or going inward, the smaller or the larger. I'm sure some philosopher has already put together a PhD, you know, dissertation on that topic, but I find it interesting.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
888.
That's pretty good stuff for, you know, first cup of coffee. in the morning.
I'm actually on my second.
Okay.
My second is kicking in right now.
All right, nice.
Yeah. 888-914-9149. Could you imagine me, Cyrus, if I had given up coffee for Lent? That would be a train wreck. Patrick's taking Lent off from the radio show because he gave up coffee. Right. That would never fly. Let's go to John in San Jose. Good morning, John.
Hi, good morning, Patrick.
Yes, welcome.
Yes, I would like to ask you a question about maybe reference the Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons, the Dan Brown movies. And just wondering, when does faith say no to science? Because I feel there's way too much science and law going on today.
Science and law, did you say?
Yeah, I think there's just, I mean, everything is science or law, like the vaccine and people getting into trouble because of things they did in their past. So okay. I'm just seeing as there's just too much science and law, and there's not enough people, you know, resting on their faith.
Okay, that's an interesting take. I've never thought of it that way. See, I think of science and faith as eminently compatible. Science is the quest, the human quest for knowledge of the universe around us, and it deals with these pre-given physical realities. So from my point of view, John, I don't think we can get enough science. The more science we do, the more it glorifies God, and the more we learn about natural revelation. I'll put it this way. God reveals the truth to us in two primary modes. The first primary mode, which we're all familiar with, is natural revelation, which we can determine, from which we can determine certain truths on the basis of what's around us. So we know about how chemicals bond with each other and react to each other. We know about gravity, and we know about the conservation of energy and various other things that we can learn from science. And that informs us more and more about what God is revealing to us through the cosmos, his physical creation. And he also reveals things to us through divine revelation. So the Holy Bible, most completely, most the ultimate revelation, of course, is in Jesus Christ. And you'll notice that, I think anyway, that when we approach the question of science from a thoroughly Catholic perspective, we embrace it and we look to see what it can tell us. But at the same time, we realize that science can't tell us everything. There are far more things that are true that exist that science doesn't have the wherewithal to tell us anything about. So certain things are philosophical in nature, and we rely upon not just science, but also divine revelation to see the bigger picture. So for me, I don't see that there's too much science. Maybe if nothing else, there's sort of an unbridled scientism. Scientism, and this may be what you're talking about, John, scientism generally refers to this notion that science has all the answers and that everything ultimately can be explained scientifically, which is preposterous, obviously. Science has no way of measuring things like love or truth, etc. And we live in a world where those things really do exist. So I would agree with you if you're saying that scientism is running amok in some circles. I can see that, yeah. But faith and reason together are very compatible, and the one assists the other. I think St. John Paul II used the analogy of two wings, and both wings together allow the bird to soar. And if you remove one or the other, you can't do that, if I'm quoting him correctly. But anyway, those are my thoughts. John, what do you think?
Yeah, I would definitely tend to agree with you. I guess what I'm saying is the scientism that's going, that's dealing with the vaccine and the COVID-19, that there's a science is a know-all to end-all. So with the churches being closed and just, I sort of see it as like in George Orwell's The Ministry of Truth. I see the Ministry of Science.
So the Ministry of Science, because in 1984, these ministries were the opposite of what they purported to be. The ministry of love, the ministry of truth, etc. So you're saying, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying that science is actually leading us away from faith? Or I want to make sure I understand your point.
I am. I think, well, it like I referenced the Dan Brown movies, especially Angels and Demons with the antimatter and Attack on the Church. I saw it as an attack from science. And I myself am a zoology major, so, mm-hmm. I love science. But the last year, all I hear about is the science of the virus and the vaccine. And it's just made me think that it's the know-all to end-all, and no one can speak against it.
And you know what's odd about that, John, is that even within the scientific community, there have emerged contradictions. People saying you got to wear the mask, other people, scientists, saying the mask is not going to help you. So even within the scientific community, there seems to be some disagreement. Maybe not in any majority sense, but hey, John, that's an interesting topic. Thank you. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show and your phone calls right after this. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Love it. Welcome to the Taco Tuesday edition of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Thanks for listening. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's get over to San Diego and talk to Janet. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I'm not supposed to ask you. Anyway.
Everybody does, though. Everybody, they're told, don't ask Patrick how he's doing, and then everybody says it. So that's okay. You're in good company.
I think you're not supposed to do that. Anyway, my question is a very simple one. Is it reverent to attend a birthday party on Holy Saturday? Seeing that we're in the Triduum and...
I'm going to say it's going to be a judgment call, and there will be some questions you can ask yourself. If it's a birthday party that because of families in town for Easter and everybody's there, but a week later they won't be there, I don't think you're doing anything wrong or sinful if you were to have a birthday party on Saturday. Keep in mind that, it's the Triduum in preparation for Easter Sunday. But you might think of it, if it's that on Holy Saturday, that it's sort of like a vigil celebration of the person's birthday, which is, in a way, sort of ordered towards celebrating Jesus' resurrection on Easter Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure there are people who would be more rigorous than I who would say, oh, no, don't do that, because that's, you should be focusing on the death, burial, and resurrection of the Lord. And I understand that perspective, but I don't think we need to be so rigorous if it's Holy Saturday. Now, if it were Good Friday, I would say, yeah, don't celebrate a birthday party on Good Friday. So Holy Saturday, I don't see a problem with that, honestly, as long as, you don't forget about what's going on in the bigger picture. That would be my approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Is it your birthday?
You've answered a question I've had for many, many years. Mm. No, I've got a nephew and my grandson. They every other year, they always coincide with Easter, and so it's always been a dilemma.
Yeah, so understandable. Well, I hope it's a happy birthday, and that the Lord blesses everybody who celebrates it.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Janet. Cyrus, half the time when a caller says, I have a very simple question, I think what they're really saying is, can you please keep your answer short? I think what they're saying is, can you just give me a simple answer?
Very intuitive of you.
Yeah. That's my perception. I want to tell you a true birthday-related story, Cyrus. It's not about me. It's about my aged father, who will be, he's 83. And his birthday is on Christmas Day, December 25th. And I never knew this about my dad until only some years ago when he confided to me Not that this is like top secret or anything like that. I just never knew it. It never dawned on me. But he shared with me that as a kid especially, and even I suppose into adulthood, he always felt kind of sad and a bit ripped off because he never actually had a birthday. Everybody, all of his brothers and sisters and all of his pals, his cronies, they would all have birthdays at different times of the year, but he never did because his birthday was on Christmas. So on Christmas, he would get the same present. You know, he would get two or three presents. His brothers and sisters would get two or three presents. They're like, oh yeah, happy birthday, Bernie. But it was never, never a big deal because it was on Christmas. And ever since he shared that with me, I've gone out of my way. I've tried really hard to make sure that he has a distinct birthday present from Nancy and me, and that we wish him happy birthday and make a fuss over his birthday separate from Christmas. But I never really thought about the people who have birthdays on big holidays like Easter or Christmas. And I would think that many of them, they never really actually get a for real birthday celebration. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, especially from a younger person's point of view, birthday's such a big deal.
Yeah.
They probably feel ripped off.
Yeah, my dad
cheated.
Did.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, and I mean, he wasn't complaining. He wasn't like grousing about it, but I detected a kind of note of sadness. You know, like for all those years as a kid, all my friends had birthday parties and I never did. And Christmas came and went and nobody really, you know. So it made an impression on me.
You know, your answer to Janet surprised me. I actually thought you would be like, well, hey, sorry. You know, it happens on a church holiday. You don't get to celebrate. I thought you were going to be kind of hard. And
what's that song? If you don't know me by now,
yeah,
you will never, ever, ever know me.
You're full of surprises.
You never know what you're going to hear on the Patrick Madrid show.
That's right.
Yeah, I know I probably come across as, you know, Mr. Wet Blanket from time to time, but on that particular point, I think it's a judgment call, really, I do. I don't think that rigor is required on Holy Saturday. Good Friday, I would have said yes.
Right, and that's different.
Yeah. All right.
Party on.
Don't hate me because I'm beautiful, Cyrus. Do you remember that commercial?
So who do we got next here?
That's a shampoo commercial from the 70s. Okay, let's go to Patty now in San Antonio. Hi, Patty.
Hi, good morning. I have a very simple question. Hint. Just kidding.
Okay, I know what you're saying. That's okay. Go ahead.
I'm listening to you. Around a year ago, I read an article about how some bishops, because of COVID, were administering the sacrament of confirmation with a cotton ball or with a Q-tip. And my boys are getting ready to receive the sacrament. And I want to know if it would be invalid if the bishop was to use something other than his finger or hand.
No, it would not. Now, there was some question about this earlier. So a year ago, let's say, when everything was new because of COVID and all the restrictions, and a dubium was sent to the Vatican, which is a query, like in this situation, what's considered valid or invalid? And the response was, it is valid. So
perfect.
That's the simple answer to your simple question. Yeah, it's not.
Thank you so very much. I was hoping you'd say that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's not optimal in my view. And quite honestly, Patty, between you and me, I don't think it's necessary. I think it is such an exaggerated precaution, so exaggerated and unnecessary. But, you know, who am I to I don't have any say in the matter. So if it's decided to do it that way, the church has said that it's valid. But personally, I don't think it needs to be done that way, you know, but I'm just a guy with a microphone. That's all.
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you, Patty. Good to talk to you. Let's see, Amy, listening in Chicago. It's good to have you on the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question for you. My husband and I are very devout Catholic to our faith. We do the best we can. We have two young children and recently learned that we were expecting our third. And we told our in-laws, who are very devout Unitarian Universalists, and they only believe that You should have 2 children due to your carbon footprint. The Earth can't handle any more people. So their reaction, needless to say, was not loving and happy and cheerful like we were feeling. It was very, very, very mean and unexpected. And then, sorry, we lost our third baby to a miscarriage. Sorry. No, and, you know, we had forgiven them and we're praying for them and we're getting through it. And then once we lost our baby, you know, I kind of feel like we're back to square one with it. And I'm just curious, is there any, we don't know what Unitarian Universalists really believe.
They don't believe in much of anything.
The witchcraft?
No,
okay.
They're not witchcraft. They don't really believe in much of anything solid. It's a kind of a feel-good. It's not even really a church in the traditional sense. It's not sure. Christian. They don't believe that Jesus is Lord. They don't believe that he is our Savior and Redeemer. It's kind of a feel-good religion, very left-wing, very caught up into political leftist causes. And it's all about the brotherhood of man, and let's think happy thoughts, and you know, be sure that you recycle, and you know, things of that nature. It's kind of a feel good leftist political environmentalist quasi religion, without much real content.
Sure, that makes sense. And then, out of curiosity, I don't believe really that this is how God would work, but there's not like any chance that, you know, that hatred coming towards the baby could have caused us to lose the baby or anything, right? Like that's not like a curse type thing. Okay.
No, you can put that out of your mind, Amy. And I realize that, you know, just me telling you that, it's easier said than done. I realize that. And you're grieving right now, you and your husband. So my heart goes out to both of you. How long ago, if you don't mind my asking, how long ago did this happen?
Sure. So we lost the baby on Valentine's Day, so about a month ago, and I was 12 weeks long. So
okay, yeah, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Well, Nancy and I, we always thought that miscarriage was for other people because we had 11 happy, healthy children, and everything was great, and there was never even a twinge of a problem with any of the pregnancies. And then, out of the blue, our 12th pregnancy ended in miscarriage. So we both can understand the grief that you and your husband are experiencing. But you know what? God is good, and you're faithful to him, and you and your husband are seeking his blessings. So my advice would be, as you process through your grief and as you move beyond it, as we all do in due time, just be open to God's plan for your marriage, as I'm sure you already are. And in due time, I'm quite confident he will bless you with more children. And that will make this little cross that you're carrying, well, it's not a little cross, but you know, the little baby that you lost, this cross that you're carrying, he will wipe your tears away, and he will bless you in ways that will help you, you know, not feel so sad anymore.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. That information should also help us heal and move to forgiving them even more. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. My guess, Amy, is that they said this out of ignorance. In other words, they've been brainwashed with the leftist nonsense. You know, Paul Ehrlich, I'll just give you just a quick background, if you don't mind, Amy. There's a guy named Paul Ehrlich who in the late 60s, he wrote a book called The Population Time Bomb. He's sort of like Professor Emeritus now at Stanford University. But it was a bestseller, and in his book, he purported to demonstrate that the Earth was on a collision course with tremendous suffering because there were far too many people. And so many more people were being born than we had food for and space for and water and such for. Every single claim he made turned out to be absolutely false. And we're now on the cusp of a demographic implosion. And literally, countries like China, and I say literally because China is a good example of this, they're in panic mode right now because their demographers and their actuaries can graph it out and they can see they've got a huge global aging problem facing them because there are just not enough children being born to sustain their economy and to sustain the livelihoods of older people. And within a generation or two, there will be some severe contractions. Japan is already reaching that point. Western Europe, United States, Russia, most of the world, with few exceptions, have either gone way below replacement level in terms of fertility or they're just barely at the edge of replacement level, which is about 2.1 children per childbearing age woman. The reason I share this with you is so that you can feel good about the fact that you and your wife are bringing children into the world, because those liars who have been telling us all these decades that there are too many people, they've been proven wrong, and you are the solution to the problem. You and your husband are going to be, in essence, creating more life where they have been stifling it. And through abortion and contraception, they have been part of the problem, part of the culture of death. Now, I'm not saying this negatively about your in-laws. I don't know what their background is on this issue, but just in general, people who have held that view. So I want to encourage you and your husband to see yourselves as part of the solution. You're not part of the culture of death. You're part of the culture of life. And that's what God wants.
Great. Yeah, thank you for that. That's very encouraging. Thank you.
I'm glad. Okay. Well, be fruitful and multiply, as God said, and he will bless you. Thank you, Amy. Well, let's take, as well, the music says, whether I like it or not, we're going to take a break. Cyrus says, so let's do it. We'll come right back with more of your phone calls, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back, and thank you for listening. Once again, the number is 888-914-9149. We can get you on the air with your question. Just call me, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Federico in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning.
Gloria. Gloria in excelsis Deo, et entera pax omnibus bonae voluntatis.
Amen.
How are you doing?
I am well, thank you.
I just had, I heard the comment on that Jellyfish thing that they've been seeing with the telescope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading somewhere in the Bible where it says God created the heavens and the earth and everything in them. Mm-hmm. So if there is life, I feel, in another universe, another kingdom, I believe God created as he is the creator. Mm-hmm. But if I were to see an alien, I would ask him who was his Lord and Savior.
Well, you know, you're familiar with C.S. Lewis, right?
P.S. Lewis?
No. No, C.S. Lewis, the author, the famous British author.
No, I'm not too.
Well, let me turn you on to C.S. Lewis, Federico. He wrote a series of books for kids called The Chronicles of Narnia, but he wrote a lot more than just that. He wrote Mere Christianity and The Great Divorce and a number of other really powerful books. But he wrote a trilogy that you might find interesting. It's called the Perelandra Trilogy. So there's Out of the Silent Planet, That Hideous Strength, and I think the third one was Perelandra. And in this novel, so it's fiction, but it's sort of theologically informed fiction from a Christian standpoint. He takes the question that you're just talking about what would it be like if there were other races in different planets in the universe who were also obviously intelligent enough to be considered persons, and you know, what would God and Christianity be for them? And you know, one of the planets that he talks about in this trilogy is one where they never fell. There was like an Adam and Eve for them, and they never fell from grace. And this is all, of course, just speculation and conjecture, but it's fascinating. And he makes some really good points, not the least of which would be that regardless of where these creatures might be, they're still under the dominion of God, who is the Lord of the universe, and therefore under the dominion of the kingship of Christ, which I find fascinating.
Yes, because if God created them, they must have some kind of semblance of who their creator is.
Yeah, if in fact they're out there,
who God is.
Yeah, there's another book that you might find interesting, Federico. It's by Ray Kurzweil, and he's a really high-up dude at Google, and he did his degree at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he wrote a book, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago called The Singularity is Near, and it's a fascinating look at technology and how it's speeding up and miniaturizing, etc. But he has a section in the book in which he goes through, he kind of offers the calculations for how likely is it that there's intelligent life in the universe. And counterintuitively, I was surprised when I read that chapter, his conclusion is that it's very, very unlikely that there is advanced intelligent life in the universe. And I can't spit out all the reasons why he says that, but I thought his take on that was very interesting and rather persuasive.
One experience I had many years ago, I was in the back of a car lot, and it was about 11 at night, and I saw a ball of light, like a yellowish orange ball, the size of a grapefruit, and it just went all around the car lot. And I got up and I followed it towards the back of the lot, and it kind of like picked up poop over the trees, and then it came all around the lot. And I got in the middle of the lot, and it went up in the air, I'd say about 50 feet, and it started turning, gyrating, and spewing out these little taillights as it was turning, and then it started getting small. And this lasted like 30 seconds. And I said, whoa, what was that? And I called out to it, who are you? And it just became smaller and smaller, and it just vanished. That was one experience that I haven't told many people because I don't want them to think I'm crazy.
You just told about 10 million people just now. Federico.
Oh, my goodness.
Your secret's out.
I'm going to have to change my name then.
No, your secret's safe with me. Your secret's safe with me. Well, that is interesting, and who knows what that might have been. But yes, I agree with you. These topics are fascinating. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it very much. We'll go now to Chris in McAllen, Texas. From San Antonio to McAllen, just like that.
Good. Hi, Patrick. My question revolves around the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Okay. We recently had a loved one in my family pass away, and the person that passed away was able to receive extreme unction, final confession, and communion at their deathbed. So I would assume that they were able to die in a state of grace after that happened. But my brother thinks or is convinced that because he said a Divine Mercy Chaplet, I guess based on her diaries, at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, the day that my father passed away, that he's going to have a straight ticket to heaven. And I disagreed with him because I was trying to explain to him that, you know, even though he had last rites, there may be I guess, some reparation that has to be made for any venial sins that would have to be purified or cleansed in purgatory before he could get to heaven. So I just wanted to find out what, I guess, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, what that secret from Sister Faustina really means when saying the Divine Mercy at 3 p.m. at the bedside of someone's death.
Yes. Okay. Well, first, let me just say that the true expert on this topic is our own Drew Mariani. And as a matter of fact, he has a brand new book coming out called Divine Mercy, which you can get for free. You can get copies for your brother and anyone else you want when you go to relevantradio.com/mercy. You can sign up for it. It's free. There's no shipping or handling or anything. So that would be my recommendation if you want a deeper resource that you could share with your brother and yourself. In the meantime, though, I'll say this, that St. Faustina, as given to her by the Lord, said that great graces in conversions will take place, especially near death or at the time of death when the Chaplet of Divine Mercy is recited prayerfully. Even if the person who's dying is not reciting it, if somebody is there doing it, it has great power. So I don't in any way want to underestimate the potential for your father going straight to heaven, if in fact God deigned to give him the remission of all need to do penance for his sins. Now, it's not just the sins that are venial that you die in, but it's also the forgiven, all the mortal sins of your life that have been forgiven. So there's still reparation to be made for those. The penalty is paid by Christ, of course. It's not something we can do. But the reparation, the restitution, and the repair, which is, I guess, redundant, that's something that penance takes care of. So it's entirely possible. There's no way to know for sure, but it's entirely possible that, indeed, your dad did go either very quickly to heaven or straight to heaven. But you're being prudent, in my view, Chris, and you're not leaping to that conclusion. You're saying, yes, but it's also possible that he may be in purgatory. So if what you're leading up to is to say that you and your family should still continue to pray for your father for the repose of his soul, I would agree with you. I would not just assume he's in heaven and just not pray for him, but I would continue to pray for him for as long as you're alive. And if he gets to heaven much sooner, then your prayers are applied to somebody else who needs them in purgatory. And if it turns out that he is in purgatory for a time, well, then your prayers benefit him. So win-win, if you ask me.
Right. Yeah, thank you for the explanation. That's what I was trying to... That's my view, and I was trying to explain to my brother that it is quite possible that he could have gone straight to heaven, just like you're saying, but it doesn't automatically follow just because he said those prayers. And he wasn't at my dad's bedside. He was, you know, in a city far away. So even though he did say those prayers, yes, he could have gone to heaven, but it doesn't automatically follow that he would go to heaven. But my brother seems convinced that because of what he did and because of how he interprets the prayer, that my dad got a straight ticket to heaven mm-hmm. upon his death. And I disagree with him on that.
I think I would side with you on this issue. I think he's assuming too much. I mean, we can assume a lot and we can trust in the Lord's mercy, especially after what was said to St. Faustina, no question. But I wouldn't go to the point where you just insist that he's gone to heaven. I think your position is theologically sound and it comports with what we are told in the Divine Mercy messages. So I would side with you on this issue.
Well, thank you. That's what I was trying to tell my brother, that I feel comfortable that my father got last rites, that after those last rites were given, or after extreme unction was given, that my father was probably in pretty, his state of being was pretty much already deteriorating. Mm-hmm. And if any sins happened after that, he wouldn't be culpable for those sins, right? And then
only God knows. Only God knows. So that's the kind of thing where it depends upon how lucid he was. Was his will engaged? Was he able to really think through? If I had to guess, I would think a man who's very near death, who has just received the sacraments and is preparing to meet God face to face, is probably not inclined to willfully commit a sin. That's my guess. So the nice thing, Chris, is when you get to heaven, all these things will be made known, and you will know, and your brother will know.
Well, I feel glad that my father received extreme unction, because mm-hmm. I can at least say, well, I think at that point, you know, if he didn't make it to heaven, he's going to be in purgatory, and there's only one place you can go after purgatory, and that's heaven.
Right. So I
feel comforted in the fact that he got extreme unction on his deathbed.
Yes, what a blessing. Yeah, may he rest in peace, and I pray for consolation to you and your family in your grief, and just think how exciting it will be when we're all reunited again together in heaven. Just think of what we will have to say to each other then. I can't wait. Well, I can wait. I don't mind waiting a while, Lord, you know, a while, but eventually it's going to be awesome. Thanks, Chris. We want to make sure you have an awesome Lent, so be sure to go to relevantradio.com for our schedule of Masses and Lenten celebrations this coming Triduum. Relevantradio.com.